Reveal is brought to you by Progressive. Have you tried the Name Your Price tool yet? It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to find a rate that works for you. It's just one of the many ways you can save with Progressive. Get your quote today at Progressive.com and see why 4 out of 5 new auto customers recommend Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson. I remember September 11th. Not in a linear way, more like flashes, bits and pieces. I was crashing on my friend's couch in Brooklyn. We heard something was happening. We got up in time to watch the towers fall. Then I remember gathering with a bunch of my friends to walk around. It seemed like everyone was out, sitting on stoops, on sidewalks, but it didn't sound like Brooklyn. You know, Brooklyn has a heartbeat. It's alive, thriving. But on that day, it was muted. At one point, someone started blasting Bob Marley's No Woman, No Cry. I looked around at all the different faces, ethnicities, cultures that I was surrounded by. And as the ash began to fall, it felt surreal and scary. But at least we were all experiencing it together. A few weeks later, back home in Florida, I was feeling the seismic shift in our politics, in our country, in our world. The drums of war were banging so loud that sometimes they were the only thing I could hear. I don't recall where I saw it, but there was a sign that said, "Kill them all and let God sort them out." And all I could think about was that moment in Brooklyn when the ash was falling down. And the people all around me, Black, Latinx, white people, but also Muslims, Sikhs, folks from the Middle East. And I worried about them. Worried about what they were about to face. So today, as we remember those who died in the towers, on the plains, and in the Pentagon, we're going to examine the wars that were launched in their names. After 9/11, President George W. Bush signed the authorization to use military force. The law allows U.S. presidents to bypass Congress in order to wage war, and not just against another country, but also against any person or organization deemed a terrorist anywhere in the world.
Americans should not expect one battle, but a lengthy campaign, unlike any other we have ever seen.
Back then, I would have never imagined that this lengthy campaign would still be going on 20 years later. But it is, and hundreds of thousands of people have lost their lives as a result. Reveal's Anjali Kamat has been digging into the legacy of the so-called War on Terror. This hour, we'll hear from 3 journalists who've spent years reporting on the people caught in the fray. Anjali starts in Afghanistan, where after 20 years of fighting and $2 trillion later, the Taliban are back in power.
In October 2001, the U.S. invaded Afghanistan. And by then, President George W. Bush had already laid out the terms of the war.
Either you are with us or you are with the terrorists.
The U.S. was on the ground to fight a war on terror. They said the world is divided into good guys and bad guys, and we need to find terrorists.
Anand Gopal is a journalist. His book about America's war in Afghanistan was a Pulitzer finalist. He spent a lot of time traveling across the Afghan countryside, interviewing members of the Taliban. And his reporting helps explain why they're back in power today. But when the war began, Anand says the group was ready to accept defeat.
They actually said, "We will put down our weapons, allow us to go back home, and give us amnesty."
But 9/11 was still fresh, and the Americans said no.
The U.S. had no interest in trying to accept a surrender of the Taliban. You can't talk to terrorists, you can't negotiate with them. You should be a detainee, you should be in Guantanamo, that's it.
Here's what the Defense Secretary, Donald Rumsfeld, said at the time.
there are still a lot of senior al-Qaeda and senior Taliban people left. We went in there to root out the terrorists, to find them where they are. Our job has got a long way to go.
And to hunt them down, the U.S. military found allies among former warlords, commanders who'd been run out of power by the Taliban. Commanders like Gulaga Sherzai. He's a giant bear of a man and a flamboyant politician. There are videos of him singing on YouTube. But it's not his singing that's made him notorious. Like a lot of other warlords, Sherzai and his forces had been part of the brutal civil war of the early 90s. Many Afghans remember this as a lawless time of murders, rapes, and extortion. But to the U.S., he was one of the good guys.
So Gulaga Sherzai was a CIA asset, very close to the Americans. The U.S. brought him in to Kandahar in 2001.
Kandahar is where he'd been governor in the 90s. He'd fled to Pakistan when the Taliban emerged, but now he was back. Sherzai seized the airfield here and got a lot of the lucrative contracts to turn it into an American military base. And he became governor again. By this point, early 2002, Anand says the Taliban had stopped fighting and most al-Qaeda members had fled the country. Still, Americans were offering their Afghan allies money to turn people in.
The war on terror made many warlords extremely wealthy. Gulaga Sherzai was one of them. And so they had an incentive to continue the war. And they had an incentive to continue producing terrorists.
2 hours east of Kandahar, there was this small village called Bande Timur. A lot of families lived here, and it was filled with peach and pomegranate groves and lush poppy fields. This was opium country. And Haji Burgat Khan, a man in his 80s, was a respected elder in this village.
He was just a tribal leader, a landowner. He had a big family.
And he's an influential figure. In early 2002, he was elected to a council of elders, formed by the new president, Hamid Karzai.
He went around in the first few months of 2002 and collected weapons from retired Taliban members and delivered these weapons to Gulaga Sherzai, the governor of Kandahar. So he was completely supporting the U.S. mission.
But as Anand writes about in his book, there was one problem.
The problem was that he was involved in the drug trade, as was Gulaga Sherzai, the U.S. ally. And so Sherzai saw this as an opportunity to get rid of a rival in the trade. And so he told the Americans that this guy was Taliban.
U.S. forces in the area didn't waste any time in responding.
One night in May 2002, while he was sleeping, his door was kicked down and men fluttered into the house with torchlights and with guns. And you can imagine the women started screaming.
It was a group of about 150 soldiers alongside coalition special forces. Sources tell Anand they shot Haji Burgat Khan, arrested all the men in the village, about 55 of them, and took them to the Kandahar airfield, which was also a detention center filled with hundreds of suspected Taliban members.
Haji Burgat Khan was beaten pretty severely, and he was a frail man, and he died en route to the airfield. His son was tortured so badly that he became a paraplegic.
The Pentagon described it as a raid on a Taliban compound. At a press conference, Rumsfeld said that none of those arrested were high-level members of the Taliban.
I wouldn't call him a senior level, but below the senior level.
The U.S. was just listening to whatever their allies, people like Sherzai, were saying. So what ended up happening is that thousands of people who were innocent ended up getting arrested, sent to Kandahar airfield, people who simply were the victim of a local rivalry.
For Afghans who lived in this part of the country, the raid that killed Haji Burgat Khan was a turning point.
There was a huge protest in the soccer field in Kandahar where, for the first time, you heard anti-American chants by people who had 6 months prior welcomed the U.S.
After decades of war and hunger, Anand says people in Bande Timur had initially welcomed the Americans. But Sherzai's impunity and the rise of night raids and torture made them feel like they didn't have a place in this new American order. And over the next few years, they turned to the Taliban.
I went to his village in 2008, and every single person there was in the Taliban. I went to his village again in 2010, and nobody was living there because it had been bombed to smithereens. It's very eerie. If you drive through there today, you will see, it will look like the ruins of an ancient civilization.
What happened in Haji Burgat Khan's village was not unique. At the onset of the war, the Taliban had wanted to surrender. But just a few years into the war, their ranks were growing. The violence by the U.S. military and their proxies gave them a much wider base of support than they'd had before. And this is when the real fight began. The Taliban used suicide bombings and IEDs, while the U.S., coalition forces, and the Afghan military relied on airstrikes, drone attacks, and night raids. Anand says that instead of eliminating enemies, the war on terror ended up creating them.
32 civilians died here during the air raids in Kunduz province, frontier country.
In Ghazni province, central Afghanistan, the dead include a woman and a child, following what eyewitnesses say was a raid by U.S. forces.
Ordinary acts of living were fraught with danger. You know, going to a wedding or going to your fields, you wouldn't know if you'd come back. It's literally daily terror. And that's a word that people describe a lot, terror, which is interesting for us thinking about the war on terror.
Brown University's Costs of War project estimates that nearly 170,000 Afghans have been killed. Close to 50,000 of them were civilians. Anand got a real sense of this a few months ago when he met a woman named Shakira in a farming community. She's lost 16 members of her family to this war.
So we mean like somebody is killed by a sniper one day, somebody who was working in the fields and carrying a hot plate to make tea, and he was shot by the coalition forces because they thought it was IED.
These are deaths that Anand's reporting shows were never officially recorded. The only evidence lies on a hillside, in unmarked graves with no names or markers, just stones.
After she told me that, I realized I had seen cemeteries like this all around the South without flags, without markers. And I realized that these are also just memorials as well that are kept in people's minds.
On August 15th, Kabul fell to the Taliban. And in the flood of news on social media that day, I saw something interesting. Gulaga Sherzai, the U.S. ally who helped the Americans hunt down members of the Taliban and tip them off about Haji Burgat Khan, he was congratulating the Taliban. A week later, he was fully on their side. In a video, Sherzai is surrounded by Taliban leaders. He's pledging his allegiance to the new rulers of Afghanistan. Good guys, bad guys, it's all fluid for people like Sherzai. For decades, armed powers have come and gone in Afghanistan. Now, America's longest war is officially over, and the Taliban are forming a new government. In this environment, one of the only constants, Anand says, is adapting to survive.
Anand Gopal is the author of No Good Men Among the Living, America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghan Eyes. You can read more about Shakira, the woman who lost 16 members of her family, in this week's New Yorker. Anand's story there is called The Other Afghan Women. Reveal's Anjali Kamat reported this story. It was produced by Najib Amini. Less than 2 years after the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, the war on terror expanded in a big way.
You can't distinguish between Al-Qaeda and Saddam when you talk about the war on terror.
That's next on Reveal. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. This hour, we're looking at the aftermath of 9/11 and how it transformed not just the U.S., but so many other parts of the world. 20 years ago, just as the war began in Afghanistan, top officials from the Bush administration were already paving the way for a new battlefield over 1,000 miles away from Kabul.
One thing is for certain is that this administration agrees that Saddam Hussein is a threat.
There is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction.
He's a threat because he is dealing with Al-Qaeda.
Of course, today we know that there were no weapons of mass destruction. And there was no alliance between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. But on March 20th, 2003, in the wake of what some call the largest anti-war protest movement in history, the U.S. invaded Iraq.
These are shots being fired now in Baghdad. I want our viewers to listen in.
6 weeks later, President Bush did something a lot of us might remember. Standing on an aircraft carrier under a giant banner that said, "Mission accomplished," he announced the war was over.
Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
When he said mission accomplished, this is exactly when the violence and the tension started in Iraq.
That's Farhat Alani. He's an Iraqi French journalist who lived in Iraq at the height of the war and reported for French newspapers and international outlets like Al Jazeera and France 24. We've been talking to Farhat because he has a very special relationship with one Iraqi city, a city that's been repeatedly destroyed because of the war on terror. It's a place that many Americans who fought in Iraq will also remember, Fallujah. Reveal's Anjali Kamat takes it from here.
Fallujah is the city of 300,000 people. It's about an hour west of Baghdad. And it's where one of the most violent uprisings against the American occupation happened. In the spring of 2004, four American contractors who worked for the private security firm Blackwater, they were gunned down here. And what happened next was especially gruesome. Their bodies were burned and then dragged through the streets by an angry mob. At least two of them were then strung up from a bridge.
Fallujah, they yelled, is the cemetery of America.
We saw the images, the terrible images. Right after that, the communication from the U.S. troops completely changed. They started to describe Fallujah as the center of terrorism, the center of Al-Qaeda members in Iraq.
Farhat tells me that resentment against the American occupation had been steadily growing in Fallujah for almost a year. And 4 days after the killing of the Blackwater contractors, U.S. forces launched a major operation into Fallujah. The first battle lasted all of April and ended with the Marines withdrawing from the city a month later. And then in November, the second battle of Fallujah began.
Operation Phantom Fury unleashed the firepower of the United States military on the town they believe is terrorist central.
The only picture of Fallujah was the stronghold of jihadists.
When the fighting was happening, Farhat wasn't allowed into Fallujah unless he embedded with U.S. troops. But as a reporter, he wanted a different perspective.
I remember a lot of American journalists went in with the U.S. troops, following the operation day by day, hour by hour, and describing that side, which is important to tell, but it's not enough.
Nearly 100 U.S. troops were killed during the two battles. The U.S. military said as many as 2,000 insurgents were killed. And the Pentagon did not keep track of civilian casualties. But local hospitals did. They say 4,000 to 6,000 Iraqis died in the fighting.
Fallujah is a normal city with people living inside. Women, kids, and non-fighters just hiding in their houses and waiting for the fight to end.
Farhat knew this because this was a city he was deeply connected to. He might have grown up in France, but Fallujah was his parents' hometown.
It was something very important in my life to discover this city.
The first time Firat visited Fallujah, he was 9 years old. It was 1989, and the Iran-Iraq War had just ended. It was finally safe to travel from France, where he was born, to Iraq, the country his parents were from. And it was the kind of childhood vacation that stays with you for life, full of vivid colors, new tastes, smells, and experiences. And in Firat's case, it was about discovering an enormous extended family.
It was an amazing feeling to know that so many people knew us. They knew everything about us, and they loved us so much.
Firat still has pictures from that trip, and one of them takes him right back.
So this photo was taken 32 years ago. It's one of my best memory and most simple memory of Fallujah. I love this picture.
In the photo, there's this white Volkswagen parked right by the banks of a wide blue river, the Euphrates. That's the river Firat is named after. And sitting on top of the car are two kids, surrounded by three men dressed in white and beaming at the children with wide smiles. Sitting next to his sister on the roof of that car, Firat is holding a pistol and pointing it right at the camera.
My uncles try their best to entertain us. They did these crazy things, that, like giving me a gun. I remember feeling like a cowboy walking in Fallujah, aiming every time at my uncles, knowing that there were no bullets inside.
A few days after that photo was taken, Firat met another member of his family, a tough-looking 13-year-old called Ahmed.
He looked like Mike Tyson. You know, I'm a fan of boxing. His face, his body, the way he was walking.
This was a cousin Firat liked immediately.
He was like this strong guy, already working in the souk, in the market, in Fallujah.
Firat remembers that besides getting to know his family, there wasn't a whole lot to do in Fallujah. It wasn't a big city like Baghdad. But every time he visited as a young boy, there was one spot that always got him excited.
My uncles in the 90s took me in a very famous football stadium in Fallujah. It was a very important game between the team in Fallujah and this team in Baghdad. I remember clearly the atmosphere that was like in any football game, really joyful, the cigarettes around me, the dust, the smell, men shouting and supporting their teams.
Years later, as a reporter covering the war, Firat would visit that same football stadium again. It's January 2005, and with the battles now over, he was finally allowed to re-enter his family's hometown. Fallujah had been under siege by U.S. forces, sealed off from the world for nearly 2 months.
I remember the faces. Everything was gray. The dust, the houses, and the faces of the people. Everyone was, I don't know, sad is not enough, but terrified.
Firat hadn't heard from his family in weeks and was desperate to make sure that they'd survived. He went searching for his uncles.
Everything was destroyed. You knew by just smelling the air that some people were still buried or hidden under the rubbles.
The neighborhood where Firat's uncles lived was where most of the fight had happened.
Two of them had their houses completely destroyed.
His uncles were showing him around what remained of their city, and Firat recognized what used to be the football stadium.
I can see it clearly in my mind. It's close to a mosque, and when you go inside, it's a graveyard.
During the worst of the fighting, U.S. troops didn't allow residents of Fallujah to bury their loved ones in the local cemetery. It was just outside the city. So people had to bury them in makeshift graves, in their backyards, in nearby fields, or at the football stadium.
I felt sick, to be honest, to be inside the football stadium where I used to play and to see all those graveyards. I can say that I stopped watching football from that time.
Firat walks down onto the field past rows and rows of gravestones. And then he sees some that he recognizes.
My name is Firat Al-Ani, and I saw the names on the graves. And they had the same names, Al-Ani. Among those victims were three members of my family, cousin that I used to play with when I was a kid. And two of them were teenagers. They were 16. I didn't know they were fighters. It was a surprise and something, to be really honest, something of a pride in the family.
During the battles, Firat had imagined that his family had been hanging on, trying to survive, waiting out the shootings and bombings. And some of them were, but not all of them.
My uncles, I can say that at least two or three of them took part in the battle.
Firat's uncles had been officers in the Iraqi army. And when the U.S. decided to dismantle the Iraqi army, they'd lost their jobs, benefits, and any prospect of future work. They tell Firat they weren't a part of Al-Qaeda and that they joined the insurgency after the American assault on their city.
Because they thought that the American came in, killed innocent people and occupied the city, and they thought it wasn't right and that they had to defend themselves.
Being such an active part of the fight transforms his family.
You know, living a life where you don't know if you would come back alive at home, it must change your feelings, it must change your thoughts, for sure.
And Firat starts to see that change in one uncle in particular. He's in that old photograph from his first visit to Fallujah.
I remember talking to my uncle and the window was open, the curtain was open, and American Humvee came into the street. And the face of my uncle completely changed. He closed the window, closed the curtain, and he said something with an anger that I've never seen. And I would be completely honest, I saw that he was capable of killing. I felt those people lived something that I could maybe never understand. It scared me because I understood that my uncle was capable of things that I've never imagined.
On the same trip to Fallujah, Firat asked his uncles about his cousin Ahmed, that strong older boy he'd looked up to as a kid.
Ahmed was a kind of mirror to me. He was the person I could have been. And Ahmed had nothing against American before 2003.
His uncles tell him that Ahmed had joined the insurgency during the first battle of Fallujah. But he'd been arrested by the Americans, and his uncles say he was tortured.
He was sent to Abu Ghraib and to Camp Buka, which is another prison south of Iraq.
A few months later, Firat hears that Ahmed has been released from prison. He's just become a father, and he's found a job with the newly created Iraqi police force. Firat is hoping to go visit him, and then he hears the news.
Maybe a week after he went out from the jail, he was killed not by the American, but by members of Al-Qaeda in Iraq.
Firat tells me that Ahmed was kidnapped, interrogated, and tortured before being killed.
They released the corpse in front of his house, and on his chest was a DVD with his interview that I've seen.
Al-Qaeda in Iraq called Ahmed a traitor.
That's someone who joined the Iraqi government and that had to be killed.
It wasn't easy to be a young man like Ahmed in Fallujah. Sticking with the insurgency meant risking capture by the Americans. And trying to work with the Iraqi government could get you killed by extremists.
I remember, still today, asking myself, what would I have done if I was an Iraqi born in Fallujah? Maybe I would be among them. Maybe I would have been someone who would defend his family, his city, his country.
During the war, Firat stayed in Iraq for 5 years, and then he spent another decade returning every year, always as a journalist.
I've never been to Iraq since 2003 for a personal reason. When I think about it, I only went to Iraq to describe the sadness, the craziness of what was going on.
Firat says he feels guilty sometimes. He has a French passport and could leave when things got too dangerous. But his family in Fallujah, they're stuck. And they've lost so much.
What was taken away, especially after the U.S. invasion of 2003, was hope.
He says the war has destroyed Iraq's social fabric. Firat used to feel a close connection to his family in Fallujah. Today, he's barely in touch with them.
Today, they're all by themselves. To the point that it's very difficult for me to talk to my uncles. They don't even talk to each other. This is something very deep. The war is not only about destruction of physical things. It's also the minds. It's also the culture. And again, the social ties. And it has been destroyed.
Firat says there needs to be a real reckoning with the legacy of the war.
How can you have a normal life with no memory of a normal country? On what will you build your future? A graveyard or what? This is the question.
He wants people to remember that Iraq wasn't always like this.
Even if it was not perfect at all, a happy Iraq was possible and may be possible in the future. Because it happened, and I was there.
There's no official number of how many Iraqis died from the war. Conservative estimates put the death toll at nearly 300,000. That story was reported by Reveal's Anjali Kamat and produced by Najib Amini. Firat Alani is a French-Iraqi journalist and the author of two graphic novels, The Flavors of Iraq and Fallujah, My Lost Campaign. When we come back, we look at how the war on terror expanded.
With Iraq and Afghanistan, there were troops on the ground. In Yemen, it was a complete opposite. They're the ghosts. They land on you and then they disappear.
That's coming up next on Reveal.
Reveal is brought to you by Progressive. Have you tried the Name Your Price tool yet? It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to find a rate that works for you. It's just one of the many ways you can save with Progressive. Get your quote today at Progressive.com and see why 4 out of 5 new auto customers recommend Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hi, I'm Emily Harris, a reporter and producer here at Reveal. We're a nonprofit newsroom, and we rely on support from listeners like you. To become a member, text the word REVEAL to 474747. Standard data rates apply, and you can text STOP at any time. Again, text REVEAL to 474747. Thank you for supporting the show.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is REVEAL. I'm Al Edson.
Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there.
Today, 20 years after the September 11th attacks, we're looking at the impact of the so-called war on terror.
It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated.
It didn't just mean boots on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan. The war on terror also meant drones in the sky in countries across the globe.
America's secret war, those escalating drone attacks in the air.
Most drone deaths are happening in Pakistan.
20 years after 9/11 and four presidents later, U.S. counterterrorism operations have touched almost every continent and now stretch across 85 countries. Thousands of U.S. drone strikes have been reported from North Africa all the way to South Asia. With them came a new type of covert warfare and a new type of trauma.
I've been to front lines. I know what it means to be afraid of, like, being shot at and stuff like that. But this is a whole different level of fear that is constant.
Safa Al-Ahmed is a journalist and documentary filmmaker who spent several years reporting out of Yemen, a country the U.S. is not officially at war with.
We're working with Yemen's government to prevent terrorists from reassembling there.
But it's been a key partner in America's war on terror right from the start.
With Iraq and Afghanistan, there were troops on the ground. Yeah, it was overwhelming, right? In Yemen, it was a complete opposite. They're the ghosts.
Safa has been talking to Reveal's Anjali Comet about what America's post-9/11 wars have meant for Yemen, the most impoverished country in the Arab world. Here's Anjali.
I've been watching Safa's documentaries for years now.
Journalist Safa Al-Ahmad spent months reporting from the middle of the conflict.
I remember seeing her reporting for Frontline and the BBC and just being so impressed.
She negotiated rare access to the Houthi rebels as they advanced.
Safa has spent a lot of time working in Yemen, but she's actually from Saudi Arabia, a country that, with America's backing, has been part of a brutal civil war in Yemen. And now, multiple armed groups control different parts of the country.
You have the Houthis, and then you have ISIS, and then you have Al-Qaeda, and then you have the Saudis, and you have the Emiratis, and you have the countless other Yemeni militias.
Among this web of warring factions is a local offshoot of Al-Qaeda, which started seizing territory in the south.
They took huge parts of South Yemen, and the drone strikes started happening more frequently.
That included the 2011 strike against the American cleric Anwar al-Awlaki. He was one of the leaders of the Al-Qaeda offshoot in Yemen.
The death of al-Awlaki marks another significant milestone in the broader effort to defeat Al-Qaeda and its affiliates.
But it's not just known Al-Qaeda members who've been targeted in drone strikes. The U.S. sometimes didn't even know who it was killing. A tactic known as signature strikes allowed the U.S. to target groups of men and boys over 16 without knowing who they are. And the attacks were justified because their age, location, and something about the way they were behaving carried the so-called signature of military activity. But the problem is, no administration has specified what that behavior is. And Safa says the strikes have left everyone living in parts of the country where Al-Qaeda might be present in a constant state of terror. They've had to be very careful about where they're going and who they associate with.
Just behaving or being in the same space as an alleged Al-Qaeda person is enough to get you killed, right? How do you work with that?
Under President Obama and President Trump, nearly 400 drone strikes hit Yemen. And neither administration would say exactly how many people that killed. Independent estimates of the dead from organizations like the Bureau of Investigative Journalism range from 1,000 to more than 1,700. About 3 years ago, Safa was in this tiny, isolated village called Yakla. She was making a documentary for Frontline and BBC News Arabic. And on her first day there, this young man was driving her through some rough mountain roads. He was taking her to the site of a recent drone attack. And that's when she realized how doing something completely routine could have deadly consequences.
One of the most frightening scenes I saw of the drone strikes was a pickup truck of a guy that sold chickens, right? And the pickup truck is decimated, absolutely destroyed, right?
The Pentagon hasn't commented on this particular strike, but the Yemeni human rights group Muwatana looked into it. They say the man was transporting food to families in need. Safa's driver also tells her the same thing, and when she's done filming him, she puts away her camera and is getting ready to leave. That's when she and her driver hear something overhead.
It's kind of like a huge insect, right? Like there was this buzzing, menacing noise.
Immediately, her driver starts panicking.
The driver was really freaked out by it, right? And he's like, we need to go now.
So she jumps into the truck and turns on her camera. The driver has got this little clip-on mic attached to his shirt.
He heard the drone and he was frantically tearing off the mic because he thought this electronic thing was a signal to the drone and that we would be a target, right?
As they're in the truck speeding down the road, Safa has this moment where she thinks to herself, we're in a part of Yemen known to have Al-Qaeda and ISIS militants. Do we look suspicious to the people watching us from that camera and that drone?
It's terrifying because there's no logical way of protecting yourself. There's no way of you knowing, I'm not a terrorist, so I'm not going to be targeted. Nothing matters. Nothing matters.
In Arabic, that means it's done. It's over. And a few seconds later, the driver pulls up by a field and does something that Safa says she'll never forget.
He puts his head out the window and he's like, you have a niqat.
Qat is this plant that's really popular in Yemen. It's a mild stimulant and a bit like chewing tobacco. This field is full of it.
The surrealism of how you could be so scared and think you're going to die, and then immediately afterwards, you're like, okay, now life goes on. Let's go pick some qat. But that was their life there, right?
Safa wasn't in Yakla just to report on the drone strikes. She'd actually come to the village to report on the aftermath of this botched ground raid by U.S. forces.
The military operation was the first authorized by President Trump.
Just 5 days after President Trump's inauguration, he authorized this raid by a team of Navy SEALs into Yakla. They were supposed to target a senior Al-Qaeda leader. But reports quickly emerged that the raid had gone horribly wrong.
Today, we know the high-stakes gamble to capture El Rimi was not a success.
A big firefight broke out about 4
resulted in the death of Navy SEAL Ryan Owens and at least 20 civilians.
It wasn't just the American Navy SEAL who had died in the raid. Residents tell Safa at least 30 Yemeni civilians were also killed. That includes 7 women, 9 children, and a 3-month-old baby.
If you look at the ages of some of the children and women that were killed, I don't know how you could defend it and say that they were terrorists. The women of the village were describing it as, and everybody tried to stay put, but some were trying to flee, and the ones who did try to flee got shot.
One man she meets has saved some of the spent munitions from that night. And a group of children pick through them as he shows them to her. While she's there, Safa interviews this tribal leader named Abdulillah Al-Dahab. The Pentagon says his brothers were Al-Qaeda leaders. Both of them, along with his 11-year-old son, were all killed in the raid. Even if I am the one they want to target, why should innocent lives be put in danger? He tells Safa his brothers were not part of Al-Qaeda. He says one of them was a commander who worked for the Yemeni government. That's the side backed by the U.S. Safa tells me he suspects he's been targeted because of his wife's family.
Al-Dahabs are in-laws of the Awlaqis, which is why they've been put on the map, sadly.
his brother-in-law was Anwar al-Awlaki. That's the American cleric the Obama administration killed in that drone strike 6 years earlier. During the raid, Awlaki's 8-year-old daughter was also killed. Villagers tell Safa a bullet struck her in the neck. And since the attack, Abdulillah Dahab's home has been hit by drones twice. He's gone into hiding.
I mean, how cursed is one family?
And it's a burden the whole village now carries.
They're resigned to that their village will always be a target and that any one of them could die at any moment.
Under the Trump administration, dozens of drones struck Yaqla after the raid. And the repercussions of being identified with al-Qaeda run deep. Villagers tell Safa they can't get passports, scholarships, or jobs. Yaqla doesn't even have any teachers left. The only school in the village hasn't reopened in 4 years.
I don't think that Americans understand how powerful they are in destroying people just by claiming that they are terrorists or affiliated with terrorism.
An internal Department of Defense report concluded that 35 enemy combatants were killed in the raid, along with 12 anonymous civilians. But the survivors in Yaqla want more information.
Give them the dignity of acknowledging that you have killed their specific family member and that they were civilians or not. But be transparent about it.
We reached out to the Pentagon about the Yaqla raid and the subsequent drone strikes, but they haven't responded. They didn't respond to Safa either when she reached out with questions from the families in Yaqla.
Yaqla really devastated me. And it perfectly encapsulates everything that is wrong with the post-9/11 American foreign policy when it comes to counterterrorism.
This whole struggle that people in Yaqla are grappling with, what it means to be labeled a terrorist. For Safa, it's personal. She grew up in Saudi Arabia, but hasn't been able to return since 2014. That's when the BBC aired a documentary she made.
The police open fire. More are injured.
It's an inside look at an uprising by Saudi Arabia's Shia minority. But the Saudi authorities weren't happy with the film.
They actually wrote an official letter from the Saudi embassy in London to the BBC, numbering all the crimes I've committed as a Saudi citizen, right? They accused me of being in touch with terrorists, so now I can never go back home because of this label.
They took the lead from the Americans of using that language to justify silencing anyone.
She's talking about the language of the war on terror, the framing and the justification it's offered for governments around the world, whether they're confronting the threat of terrorism or just crushing dissent.
It's become the tool, the cudgel, that is used against anybody who speaks out against what the government is doing.
Safa was actually in New York when I spoke with her. And after the interview, we got on a train and headed to Lower Manhattan. We wanted to see the 9/11 memorial together. She'd never been.
I was here right after September 11th. So it's been 20 years.
The sound of the waterfall drowns out the chatter of tourists. We're making our way around the two square reflecting pools where the towers once stood. Almost 3,000 people died that day. And hundreds of thousands were also exposed to the toxic dust from Ground Zero. Safa and I are talking about all of the pain and suffering this day caused and how it radiated around so many other parts of the world.
What do you think someone from Yaqla would say to this? If you were walking around here with the man who was in hiding.
Yeah. I think he would cry. that he lost most of his family for this forever war. They're still living the nightmare.
September 11th was so much more than a day. It was devastating. But the terror that people felt, that feeling of being under attack, it lasted for one horrifying day. And for people in parts of the world caught up in the so-called war on terror, that feeling, it hasn't gone away.
Upwards of 900,000 people have died from the wars following 9/11. That includes soldiers, contractors, aid workers, journalists, and civilians. The Costs of War Project says civilians make up the biggest portion of those killed. On this anniversary, we should never forget. Two decades after September 11th, it's still fresh. The planes, the firefighters running in, the death that followed. Everyone who lost their lives because of that day deserves to be remembered. And that includes the hundreds of thousands of victims of the wars that followed. Safa Al-Ahmed is a journalist and filmmaker from Saudi Arabia. Her documentary on Yakla for Frontline and BBC News Arabic is called Targeting Yemen. Today's show was reported by Anjali Kamat. Our lead producer for this week's show was Najib Amini. Cynthia Rodriguez and Brett Myers edited the show. Thanks to Frontline and BBC News Arabic for permission to use audio on the Yemen story. And thanks also to former executive editor Esther Kaplan for helping envision this hour. You can check out more from reporters Farhat Elani, Safa Al-Ahmed, and also Afghan reporter Emran Farooz on our website, revealnews.org. Victoria Baranetsky is our general counsel. Our production manager is Amy Mustafa. Score and sound design by Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Fernando, my man, Yo Aruda. That help this week from Stephen Rascon and Claire C. Note Mullen. Our digital producer is Sarah Merck. Our interim CEO is Annie Schabel. Sumi Agarwal is our interim editor-in-chief, and our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camarado, Lightning. Support for Reveals provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, the Hellman Foundation, the Democracy Fund, and the In As Much Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Letson, and remember, there is always more to the story.
Support for Reveal comes from Odoo. Meet Dan. Dan built a kick-ass bike company, but his old software made it impossible to keep up with demand. It took so much time just to make things work, it was sucking the life out of him. Then he found Odoo. Odoo automated his business by integrating inventory, manufacturing, accounting, and marketing. Now he can meet the demand and grow even faster with the e-commerce app. Thanks to Odoo, Dan doubled his revenue and can focus on what matters. Go to odoo.com/reveal to start a free trial. That's odoo.com/reveal.